Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We are jumping straight into a topic that, well, it's everywhere. You see it on streaming, playlists, stores, but we almost never really think about it critically. The whole idea of world music.
That's right. And for this deep dive, we're looking at a really crucial book that takes it apart, World Music. A very short introduction by the ethnomusicologist Philip V. Bowman. He's quite esteemed in the field.
Yeah, he really is. And the mission here for you listening is pretty vital. Bowman's book, it's not like a travel guide to different sounds, no. It's a deep, critical breakdown of the label itself. We're trying to get the knowledge quickly but thoroughly to understand the politics, the power stuff that's kind of baked into these categories we just click on, you know, when we listen globally.
Exactly. Because it matters so much today. We think, oh, digital age, music is global. It's all democratic now.
Right. Borderless.
But Bowman shows us, wait a minute, the categories we use to sort all that music, a lot of them are basically leftovers from colonial ways of thinking.
Okay. So before we completely tear down this category, let's maybe introduce the person doing the tearing down. Tell us about Philip Bowman.
Yeah, understanding his background really helps see why his argument carries so much weight. Bowman is, well, he's a major figure. A highly distinguished American ethnomusicologist, he holds a big chair at the University of Chicago, the Ludwig Rosenberger Distinguished Service Professorship.
So a heavyweight.
Definitely.
And what makes his angle so distinct, I think, is how interdisciplinary he is. He's not just, you know, looking at notes on a page or rhythms. He's mixing musicology with anthropology, with history, cultural theory.
Right. Which lets him tackle these huge societal forces, like how music connects to nationalism, or how communities in diaspora use music, how identity gets negotiated through sound. It's bigger than just the music itself.
He sounds less like a music critic recommending albums and more like a cultural historian asking why.
Exactly. That's his unique qualification. He's committed to digging up the complex social, political, economic stuff hiding behind these labels that we just accept as, you know, normal or neutral. He makes us question the whole framework.
So he's basically saying the system we use to classify global sound is fundamentally problematic, challenging the idea that there's one center to the musical world.
Precisely. And that leads us straight into the book's core argument, which is really important to grasp right off the bat.
Which is?
That world music isn't some natural thing just out there waiting for us to find it.
Ah, right. It's not like discovering a new species.
No. Bowman stresses it's fundamentally a Western construct. It came out of very specific moments in history. Colonial encounters, early attempts to collect exotic music ethnographically, and then, more recently, the forces of the modern market.
So definitely not neutral. It comes with baggage.
Absolutely loaded with baggage. And the core critique, the real problem with the label, is all the assumptions it carries.
You mean like lumping wildly different things together, like, I don't know, tuba on throat singing and Brazilian samba and maybe Irish folk music?
Yeah.
All under one banner?
Exactly that. By doing that, Bowman argues, we're implicitly saying the West is the normal, the center. Everything else gets defined by how different it is from us. It sets up a hierarchy.
And that act of grouping, it often ends up making things seem exotic, right? Oversimplifying them, turning complex cultural practices into commodities.
Yeah, commodifying them. We consume the simplified version, and that can actually reinforce the power imbalances. You know, who gets to decide what label sticks? The sheer diversity of human music gets shrunk down into one little market niche.
So the book's goal isn't just to critique, it's to push us, the listeners, past just passively consuming this stuff.
Right. It gives us tools, a critical framework, to think about how music travels, who actually benefits when it's defined a certain way, and what the political side effects are of our own listening habits.
Okay, so moving from just being a casual listener to someone who's more active, critical, maybe even ethically engaged.
That's the idea. So let's dig into how Bowman builds this case. He starts with the history, showing the concept was basically invented for show.
Right, the historical roots. This is fascinating. He traces it back to the colonial era, specifically those huge world's fairs in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, like Paris, Chicago.
Exactly. And at these fairs, non-Western music wasn't just performed, it was staged, often in these, like, ethnic villages, very controlled environment.
Staged as spectacle.
Yes, exotic spectacle. And that staging was key because it immediately set up a cultural pecking order. Western music, especially classical, was presented as the universal standard, the high art.
While everything else was quaint. Regional, ethnic curiosity?
Pretty much. Displayed as something interesting, maybe, but definitely other. And then this hierarchy got kind of cemented in academia with the rise of comparative musicology.
Ah, the early scholars collecting and archiving this music.
Yeah, they collected, transcribed, archived non-Western music. But Bowlman's critique is that this process often treated living, breathing traditions like they were static artifacts, like archaeological finds from primitive cultures.
Instead of dynamic, evolving practices, they were looking for some kind of pure origin, maybe.
Exactly. Purity and origin, not necessarily innovation or change. And this sets up what Bowlman calls a core paradox, which I think is brilliant.
Okay, what's the paradox?
Music is always talked about as this universal language, right? It transcends culture. But the reason non-Western music often appeals to Western listeners is its profound specificity, its deep tie to a particular place, a history, a ritual.
Ah, so we celebrate its universality but are drawn to its uniqueness.
Precisely. So Bowlman suggests maybe we should stop thinking about one global world of music and instead recognize there are countless overlapping distinct music worlds.
Okay, that makes sense. Multiple worlds, not just one with the West at the center. Now, he shifts focus later,
yep.
Right, to more tangible things like instruments.
Yes, in Chapter 3, he looks at musical instruments. He argues an instrument isn't just a tool for making sound. He calls it an arsenal of cultural meaning.
An arsenal? That's a strong word. What does he mean by that?
It implies it carries history, stories of trade, conquest, migration. It immediately shows that no musical tradition is purely isolated. They all borrow and blend.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Think about the guitar. We might associate it strongly with Spanish music or African music or Latin American pop music.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
But it's an immigrant instrument itself. And look at the oud from the Middle East. It clearly influenced the European lute, which then influenced the guitar. It's a constant back and forth. The arsenal metaphor just reminds us that history travels with the object.
Okay, so instruments carry history. Then he moves to the voice,
yeah.
Right?
Yes. Chapter 4, The Human Voice. He describes it as the most personal, maybe the most politically charged source of sound. When people sing together, that instantly taps into collective identity.
The vox populi, the voice of the people.
Exactly. He explores how singing becomes this powerful tool for building nationalism, for community solidarity, for political protest, for holding on to collective memory.
You can picture it easily. A national anthem, a protest song. It's immediate. It's visceral. It feels like it articulates the soul of a group.
And sometimes those voices are forced to move. That's Chapter 5, Migration and Diaspora. Bowlman argues that for migrant communities, refugees, music becomes absolutely essential. He calls it a portable homeland.
A portable homeland. I like that. It's how you keep a connection to somewhere you've lost a memory, a language, while you're trying to build a new life somewhere else.
You carry the sound of your community with you. And that very necessity, Bowlman says, drives musical change. It leads inevitably to hybridity, syncretism.
New forms emerge that don't fit neatly into those boxes the West tries to impose.
Right. Like reggae, a classic example. It grew out of Caribbean, African American influences, all swirling together in places like London. Music, like identity itself, is messy, it's layered, it constantly resists simple labels.
Which brings us, I guess, to the moment where all this theory hits the market. The big industry critique in Chapter 6, the term world music itself. It has a specific birthday, doesn't it?
It does. A now famous 1987 meeting in London.
It's just the meeting.
Yep. It was basically a business meeting. Independent record label owners got together. They were having trouble selling records that weren't pop, rock, or classical. Where do you put this other stuff in the record store?
So they needed a shelf label. A marketing category.
Purely a marketing category. World music was coined for commercial convenience, not out of some deep cultural understanding or respect.
Wow, born from needing a bin card in HMV.
Yeah.
But Bowlman points out there's a cost to that convenience, right? The packaging.
A huge cultural cost. The industry often has to sanitize the music, package it to make it easy to digest, maybe less challenging for Western ears, make it predictable.
And that ties into the whole idea of authenticity that the industry loves to sell.
Oh, definitely. They fetishize authenticity. But Bowlman's critical point is, who gets to define what's authentic? Often it's the Western producers, the critics, the market expectations, not necessarily the musicians themselves.
So the artist feels pressure to sound traditional or pure in a way that fits the Western idea of what their culture should sound like.
Exactly. It becomes a performance of authenticity for the consumer. And a great example he discusses is the Buena Vista Social Club.
Ah, yes. Huge phenomenon. Brilliant music.
Brilliant music, no doubt. But Bowman points out the complexity. Its massive success relied heavily on framing these amazing Cuban musicians as, like, rediscovered relics of a bygone pre-revolutionary era, a very specific nostalgic image of Cuba.
Which maybe overshadowed what was happening in contemporary Cuban music at the time.
It raises that question, who gets to curate the cultural memory that the rest of the world consumes? It's a really complex case study in packaging and nostalgia.
Okay, so these are powerful critiques. Let's try to distill the main takeaways, the key themes listeners can really grab onto.
Right. Theme one has to be the politics of categorization. This is fundamental Bowman. The labels we use, even seemingly innocent ones like world music, are never neutral.
They reflect power dynamics.
Absolutely. They tend to keep the West as the default center and define everything else by its difference, maintaining that cultural hierarchy.
And you can see that reflected maybe in how streaming platforms organize music. Is Western pop just music and everything else is global sounds or some niche category? That layout itself reinforces the old structure.
That's a perfect everyday example.
Yeah.
Okay, theme two, the myth of musical authenticity. Bowman really drives this home. The search for pure culture is kind of a dead end.
Because all music is hybrid.
All musical traditions are products of encountering other traditions, of exchange, of borrowing. They're always evolving. So the market pressure to sound authentically traditional can actually stifle creativity. It forces artists into performing a stereotype.
That's actually quite liberating, isn't it?
Yeah.
That means we don't have to expect music to be pure or unspoiled. We can appreciate the messiness of cultural mixing, because that's where the energy is. That's how music happens.
Exactly. It's the engine of creativity. Okay. And theme three, the imperative of critical listening. In this super connected world, Bowman argues, we have a responsibility beyond just liking the beat.
We need to engage with the context, the history, what the music means.
Yes. Engage with the social meaning behind the sound. It's about moving, listening from just passive enjoyment to something more intellectual, more empathetic.
Becoming active, informed participants, not just consumers.
Oh.
Okay, those are strong themes. Bowman's writing is sharp. Are there specific lines or core ideas that really capture his thinking?
Yeah, his arguments are potent. Let's pull out three core concepts, maybe not direct quotes, but the essence.
Okay, first one.
The idea that really reframes everything. World music isn't something out there to be discovered. It's an idea we invented in the West to organize our encounter with the music of the other.
Wow. Okay, so it's about our framework, our invention, not the music itself. That forces us to look at the history behind how we listen.
Precisely. Colonialism, ethnography, how we perceive difference. Okay, second concept, that sharp critique of the market. The global music industry doesn't sell music, it sells authenticity. But this authenticity is often a stereotype, packaged for the comfort of the Western consumer.
So it's selling a comfortable image, not necessarily the messy reality. And the power to define what's genuine lies with the buyer, not the artist. That's a tough one.
It really is. And the third one flips the whole hierarchy.
Yeah.
Every musical tradition is world music because every tradition emerges from encountering other traditions.
Ah, so that puts Western classical or American pop right in the same boat. They're all products of mixing and borrowing.
It democratizes the whole thing. Hybridity, not purity, is the normal state for all music. No culture lives in a musical bubble.
Okay, those are really useful concepts.
Yeah.
So how do we actually use this knowledge? Like tomorrow morning when I'm scrolling through my music app?
Good question. Let's think practical application. Tip one, be a critical consumer. Next time you see that world music playlist or category, just pause.
Ask questions.
Yeah. Who made this playlist? How are the artists described? Are they complex people or just exotic symbols? If the label feels lazy or too broad, maybe dig a bit deeper. Find out what the artists call their own music. Try to be a more ethical, informed listener.
Okay, be more mindful. What else?
Tip two, enhance cultural travel. If you travel, Bowman's idea suggests maybe don't just go to the official traditional folk show for tourists.
Seek it out where it's lived.
Try to find music where it's actually part of community life, local venues, community centers, maybe even religious events, if appropriate. Treat music as a living practice, not just a tourist product.
Show respect for the context. Good tip.
Yeah.
And the third one.
Tip three, broaden the critique. The things Bowman talks about, cultural appropriation, how authenticity gets marketed, the tension between global trends and local realities, these aren't just about music.
It applies elsewhere.
Totally. Food, fashion, art, film. You can use the same critical lens to analyze how cultures interact and get represented in all sorts of media. It's a tool for understanding globalization itself.
That's really useful. It makes the book much bigger than just music. Okay, final thoughts. What really stood out or surprised you in digging into this?
For me, it wasn't just knowing the term was invented in 87. It was understanding how that specific commercial decision managed to solidify and almost weaponize those older colonial hierarchies.
Making exoticism part of the sales pitch.
Exactly. Commercial need became the judge of cultural value. That was quite striking. What about you?
I think the biggest takeaway for me is the shift Bowman forces on the listener.
Mm-hmm.
Moving away from being a collector of sounds like pinning butterflies to a board towards being a critical participant in this ongoing global conversation,
mm-hmm.
and constantly asking that question, what does this music actually do for the people who create it and live with it, politically, socially, emotionally?
Yeah, it definitely makes you confront some uncomfortable things about culture, commerce, power. It's not just about what to listen to, but how to think about listening.
So the final challenge for the listener is maybe. Now that you know this category, world music, is so loaded, what are you going to rename on your own playlist? How will you reorganize your own listening?
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.